back to room 223 with your hostess, Mrs. Norville Crandall. I enjoyed hosting this podcast so much last week, I came back for an encore. Last episode, I introduced several topics, giving you a small glimpse into multiple facets of our economic system. This time, I want to take a closer look at the stock and bond market. You know, when you're a business teacher, you have to know so much more than just business. You have to have a teaching knowledge of a variety of core subjects like math, English, economics, computers, history. So today I thought we'd have a history lesson. The majority of us understand the basics of the business cycle, and we realize that a recession is a natural part of that cycle. We can liken them to growing pains. They have to happen in order for our economy to discover new ways to grow. Historically speaking, the U.S. has endured and recovered from 17 notable recessions, dating back to 1797. The causes of the recessions range from land speculation in the newly formed United States to failed banks and railroads. What historic events do you think of when you hear recession? I bet most of you immediately thought of the Great Depression of 1929, but that was not our worst nor our longest recession. There's no doubt that the Great Depression was the biggest economic crisis up to that point. Unemployment reached 25% and GDP decreased 26.7%. It wasn't until the spending for World War II happened that the economy began to turn around. And even with the war effort, unemployment remained above 10% until the U.S. entered the war. And by the end of the war in 1945, unemployment was down to 1.2%. But that wasn't going to last. When the war ended, GDP began falling because of the demobilization and because of a sharp drop in demand for military weapons. No longer at war, we don't need military weapons. Unemployment began to rise again, causing yet another recession. Between the Great Depression of 1929 and 1970, several short-term recessions occurred, but wars and employment acts helped to end these recessions and lead to times of expansion. These endeavors, along with the Federal Reserve helping to control inflation, lessened the impact. Unfortunately, in 1987, Black Monday happened because of high interest rates and the Iranian oil embargo. The bull market that had existed for 5 years saw a dramatic fall on October 19, 1987. Beginning in the Hong Kong market, it affected every market worldwide. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 22.61% and the S&P fell 20.4%. It took 2 years for the market to recover just from the 1 day of losses. On a side note, let me take a moment here to explain about the bull and bear markets. A bull market symbolizes aggressive financial optimism and prosperity. It's a time of growth and expansion. When visiting Wall Street, you can visit Charging Bull, also called the Wall Street Bull or the Bowling Green Bull. It's a huge bronze sculpture that stands on Broadway just north of Bowling Green in the financial district of Manhattan. The 7,100-pound bronze sculpture stands 11 feet tall and measures 16 feet long and depicts a bull. It's a popular tourist destination and draws thousands of people a day. It is the symbol of Wall Street and of the financial district and a reminder of confidence and a good life. On the flip side to the bull market is the bear market, which symbolizes lean times and a pessimistic view. A bear investor believes a particular stock or market is headed downward. There is no bear statue in the financial district. This is obviously not a symbol investors want to see. A bear market occurs when the market experiences a prolonged price decline. Typically, if prices fall 20% or more from whatever the record high was. The last two bear markets were seen in 2008 with the mortgage credit crisis and in 1987 when the Dow fell 22.6%. So there's a little history about the bull and bear markets. Now let's get back to the regularly scheduled program. 1987 and 1988 also saw the introduction of market halts, or circuit breakers, as they're sometimes called. This is a regulatory measure to temporarily halt trading on an exchange to curb panic selling. These halts can apply to both broad market indexes, such as the S&P, or to individual securities. They are predefined levels ranging from 7 to 20%, and they form market curbs to reduce excess volatility. These halts allow the market time to think about what they're doing, digest the market information, and not just react at what they're seeing, but make actual rational and informed choices. Imagine if we'd had market halts in 1929. What a difference our world would look like now. In 1990, the U.S. suffered a savings and loan crisis, which sparked another recession. Savings and loans were a system to promote home ownership for the working class. They paid lower than average interest rates and offered lower than average mortgage rates. During the 1970s, stagflation and low economic growth, along with high inflation rates, devastated the S&Ls. Add to that the introduction of money market accounts in the 1980s, and people were leaving S&Ls to earn much higher rates on their savings elsewhere. This switch depleted S&L funds and caused a $4 billion a year loss. During this time, GDP fell 5.5% and unemployment peaked at 7.8%. Government intervention didn't save the S&Ls, and it wasn't until 1989 when President George H.W. Bush unveiled a bailout plan, which provided $50 billion to close all the failed banks and to stop any further losses. Bank failures, though, were not the only cause for U.S. recessions. The boom and subsequent bust in dot-com businesses caused a recession in 2001. Remember, in 1997, the internet and computers were the trending technology. Well, it started with the Y2 scare of 2000, when companies bought a whole bunch of new software because they were afraid their old software wasn't up to the transition of the 2000s. They were afraid they were going to go back to zero. And then it continued with the boom of the dot-com companies who were being overvalued and then proceeded to fail. Let's look at some examples. Pets.com was one such company selling pet products. It had an aggressive advertising campaign, but struggled with its distribution chain. Overall, it lost about $300 million of capital investment. Another site, JewishNet.co.uk, made its 17-year-old owner, 17 years old when he started this, he became a dot-com millionaire. Unfortunately, it was not the success it was hailed, and it didn't take long for the site to collapse. Another popular site was GeoCities. Here's something sad. I remember those. Where the average person, yeah, like me, could go and create their own homepage. It was a total hit. That is until Yahoo purchased it and changed the terms of service. People left in droves and found other web hosting services. These are just a few examples, and there are a lot of other ones. Can you think of any? Any dot-com, any websites, any companies that you've seen on the internet before and no longer exist today? Think about that one. Well, then came the 9/11 attack, and that worsened the recession, causing the economy to contract almost 3%, unemployment to rise over 6%, and the Dow to drop almost 700 points. This was the beginning of the war on terror and led to one of the biggest government spending programs in U.S. history, costing more than $2 trillion. The stock market closed for 4 days, oil prices fell, and the airline industry lost $5 billion because of the attacks. The most significant economic impact was the increased defense spending, leading to a debt crisis. A debt crisis is when anyone owes more than they can afford to pay off. For individuals, this debt could include mortgages, credit cards, non-revolving credit, and other bills along that line. For businesses, it's a company that has trouble repaying loans or bonds that they've taken out and issued, and therefore become a poor investment. And for sovereign debt or government debt, it happens when a country can no longer pay the interest on its international debts. While bankruptcy is often a solution for personal or business debt crisis, that option's not available to governments. There is no international bankruptcy court, so it's easier for countries to default. Sovereign debt is also not secured by any collateral. It is fully dependent on GDP and international trade. And finally, most countries can just print their own currency to pay off the debt, causing a slew of other problems, including hyperinflation. Think about Germany before the World War II, or more recently, Venezuela. One sovereign debt crisis that was in the news in 2001 was the Greek debt crisis. Greece exchanged its drachmas for euros and then expected the European Union to print more euros to pay off its debt. The EU demanded Greece cut costs, which slowed its economy, and then Greece entered a deep recession with high unemployment, political chaos, and a troubled banking system. It wasn't long before this recession had a domino effect, and Italy, Spain, and Portugal soon followed, leading the entire EU back into a recession. Unlike Greece, the U.S. debt crisis was self-inflicted because Congress refused to raise the country's debt ceiling. This caused the U.S. to default on its debt. Congress did eventually raise the ceiling, but only after installing mandatory spending cuts. Failure of Congress to raise the debt ceiling happened again in 2013, and that one led to a 16-day government shutdown and global fears that the U.S. was going to default a second time. I said earlier that the Great Depression was not the longest nor the worst. The Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 holds both those titles. There were multiple causes to this recession. The primary trigger was the subprime mortgage rate crisis, which created a global banking credit crisis. The subprime mortgage crisis happened when banks sold too many mortgages for mortgage-backed securities. When home prices fell, it triggered multiple defaults, which spread the risk to multiple. All right, let's try that again. The subprime mortgage crisis happened when banks sold too many mortgages for mortgage-backed securities. When home prices fell, it triggered multiple defaults, which spread the risk to mutual funds, pension funds, and the corporations who owned them. Just prior to this, the Fed began raising interest rates, which in turn raised the mortgage payments for those who had loans based on the Fed funds rate. This caused many homeowners to no longer be able to pay their mortgages, and they couldn't even sell their home for what they originally paid. many homes showed a price decline of 10 to 15%, which effectively eliminated most homeowners' equity, thus causing them to default on their mortgages. Alan Greenspan, the former Federal Reserve Chairman and, in my humble opinion, an economic genius, warned of this recession. He specifically cited the negative GDP growth and the U.S. budget deficit. After this announcement, the stock market experienced a widespread stock sell-off, but it quickly rebounded. The Federal Reserve didn't completely agree with Greenspan, but they did try to lower inflation and have banks work with customers to convert to fixed rate loans and to receive credit counseling. Many banks would receive benefits from the Community Reinvestment Act to support these steps. The Fed also introduced a reduced interest rate in hopes it would be enough to restore liquidity and confidence to the bank-to-bank lending as well as to the mortgage market. Even with these steps, the Fed could not stop the differences between the U.S. interest rate and the London Interbank interest rate, nor could they stop existing home sales from falling 5%. At this point, the Treasury stepped in, and they created a $75 billion super fund to buy distressed portfolios and provide liquidity to banks and hedge funds. The goal was to give banks enough time to figure out how to value various components such as the commercial paper, mortgage-backed securities, and the subprime debt. Unfortunately, foreclosures doubled and home prices continued to fall. This led to what's known as a correction in the stock market, or a decline of 10% or more in the price of securities, suggesting that it could turn into a bear market and the economy would suffer, what? Oh yes, you guessed it, another recession. The crisis continued to worsen and the government, despite its best efforts, barely kept one step ahead of a complete financial collapse. Unemployment rates grew to almost 10% and GDP declined 2.6%. Jobless benefits were extended and key tax cuts were put into place to help with stabilization. Our economy once again entered a period of declining unemployment rates and growing GDP, and we haven't seen a recession since the natural occurring one in 2015. Well, that is until now. In between 2015 and now, we have been experiencing what's known as a Goldilocks economy. This type of economy exists when growth is neither too hot, causing inflation, nor too cold, creating a recession. This economy is often the result of both the monetary and fiscal policies working together to keep the economy moving at a healthy, steady pace. Although rare, we have experienced several periods when the monetary and fiscal policies created a stable economy. Those times included after the Korean War, during the Vietnam War, when Kennedy enacted the food stamp program and farm supports, during Obamacare, and when the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act was enacted and enforced. Most recently, President Trump's tax plan helped set the stage for a continued Goldilocks economy. All of these things created solid economic growth without inflation. And now here we are, year 2020, fighting a pandemic and facing a recession. And how do we know we're facing a recession? Let's look at the numbers. Unemployment is rising and is projected to grow to 18% or more. GDP is decreasing and the stock market is going down and the bond market rose for only high quality stocks, bonds. Typically, bonds are safer than stocks, and when stocks go up in value, bonds go down. Stocks do well when the economy is booming, but when investors feel less confident, they tend to invest in bonds, because bonds are a sure thing. Historically, when stock prices have fallen, investment-grade bond yields have also typically fallen, but their prices have risen, helping to offset losses from stocks to investors who have allocated assets to bonds as well. So that makes a balanced portfolio. However, there's been an odd occurrence this time, and instead of investment-grade bond prices rising, it was the high-quality bonds that reflected a rise in price. And this is unusual because high-quality bonds are riskier than investment-grade bonds. Fidelity Investment feels that the disorder between the high-quality and investment-grade bonds in the bond market, while stock prices are falling, upended the familiar relationship. Because of this, the Federal Reserve is seeking massive intervention by cutting interest rates to get the bond market back in order. According to Ben Carlson from A Wealth of Common Sense, bonds are once again proving to be the most valuable diversifier on the planet during a stock market sell-off. They are doing their job as a portfolio stabilizer and as a stock market hedge. The biggest concern is with the Fed lowering the interest rates. What will the long-term returns be for bonds? They are currently guaranteed to be basically nil, and if any inflation occurs, it could mean a negative real return on the bonds. So while bonds dampen the volatility compared to the stock market and give investors a way to rebalance a down market, the margin for safety is now razor thin, and there are going to be a lot of pension plans in trouble because of this. The reason is simple economics. So let's look at an example. Assume an investor owns a bond that pays 5% annually on a coupon rate. If interest rates go up to 6%, new bonds being issued reflect these higher rates. Investors naturally want bonds with a higher interest rate. This reduces the desirability for the bonds with that 5% interest rate. Therefore, the price for those bonds go down to coincide with the lower demand. On the other hand, assume interest rates go down to 4%. That bond that's paying 5% is now much more attractive. There's an increased demand for bonds with higher coupon rates that pay more. So prices on prevailing bonds go up. Now, while no one can predict the future, you need to know the information to make rational decisions. To have the full picture, we need to look at what's going on in the stock market. On February 12, 2020, the stock market closed at around 29,551. By March 23rd, the stock market closed at 18,591. That's a drop of 37%. As of April 28th, the market was priced around 24,101, showing an increase, though, of 29% since the March 23rd low. The three largest one-day declines to date during this pandemic were on March 9th, March 12th, and March 16th. March 9th is being referred to as Black Monday 2020 and was one of the Dow's worst single-day point drops in history. Well, that was until March 12th, when it had a drop of 9.99% and entered a bear market, effectively ending its 11-year bull market run that began in 2009. This was fueled as investors were confronted with evidence that a steep decline in the world's largest economies may have already begun as businesses shut down and borders were closed due to the coronavirus. That was March. Now we're in May, and we are beginning to see some light. The stock market is having a rally, but the question is, did it go too far too fast? According to Simon Mayrhofer from the Market Watch, some indexes rebounded over 40%, and that's the fastest rally we've seen from a 52-week low. And this could be followed by a sizable decline until more stability is evident. One of the biggest questions facing Wall Street investors, according to Mark DeCambre of Market Watch, is, will the U.S. stock market retest bear market lows that had been put in place on March 23rd? And if history is any guide, then when a stock market slips into a bear market, typically it tends to return to that low more often than not. And that's according to data from Bespoke Investment Group. With all the volatility and questions and future predictions, what does that mean for the average person? What does that mean for you and me? It means we need to think about systematic investing or dollar cost averaging. Dollar cost averaging is a strategy in which an investor places a fixed dollar amount into a given investment on a regular basis. The investment generally takes place each and every month, regardless of what's occurring in the financial markets. As a result, when the price of a given investment rises, the investor will be able to purchase fewer shares. But when the price of the particular security declines, the investor will be able to purchase more shares. Here's a hypothetical example. Let's say an investor decides to buy a stock in XYZ company for $100 and then invests another $100 every month for the next 3 months. When the original purchase was made, the stock was trading at $75. So the investor received 1.33 shares for his $100 investment. The next month, the stock is trading at $50, so the investor gets to purchase 2 shares. Month 3, the stock is trading at $80, and the investor can only purchase 1.25 shares. And in the 4th month, the stock is trading at $60, and the investor purchases 1.66 shares. So at the end of the period, the investor owns 6.24 shares of stock. Now, if the client invested the entire $400 at the original investment cost when the stock was trading at $75 a share, they would only own 5.33 shares. So by investing a set dollar amount over a period of time and buying shares at higher lows, the investor ended up with more shares. This is the strategy that companies use when they offer employees 401k or other retirement accounts. It's kind of like the tortoise and the hare. Keeping the steady pace wins the race. There are some other things that we need to keep in mind during this investment. Assuming that we have no withdrawals, when the value of your investment goes down, the number of shares still remains the same. They aren't reduced. So if you don't sell your investment, you're not losing anything. It's strictly a paper loss. For example, my retirement is sitting safely in the market and I'm not touching it. I feel fairly confident that over the next 6 years and by the time I retire, the financial market's going to be stable again. And during that time, I'm just going to continue to maintain my systematic investment strategy to maximize my investment. The other thing is your time horizon becomes just as important as your risk tolerance. If you're young and saving for retirement, that bucket load of money you're saving will have a longer time to accumulate than, say, the college education account that you might start for a child. The longer you have before accessing your money, typically the more equities you're going to have in your portfolio. As you begin to reach your retirement goals, your financial advisor is going to work with you to decrease the percent of equities and increase the percent of bonds. Remember, bonds are stabilizing and a sure thing. And you're going to come out with some other fixed income products included. When you can do this, while you can do this on your own, I recommend always work with a financial advisor that you trust and who will work with you through the entire different stages of your life. You know, what your needs are as a teenager or a first-time employed young adult, it's much different when you become a family member or when you're getting ready for retirement. So find a financial advisor and work with them. Also, remember markets go through many business cycles. There will be highs, there will be lows. Don't panic. Again, talk with your financial advisor. They'll help you guide you through these difficult situations. Remember to always get all the facts. Make informed decisions based on your research. Don't just give a knee-jerk reaction. As always, this information can be found by searching the internet and in the news. Make sure to look at multiple resources. Never be content with just one viewpoint. I want to give special thanks to Tori Gable, an LPL financial advisor working with Web Financial Group, for helping me with the direction, the examples, and much of the information used in this recording. And until next time, have a great week. Stay safe, healthy, and happy, and good luck in all of your endeavors, providing they're legal and moral. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it.